Campus FM presents Treasures from Malta. This episode was originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series, produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. Hello and welcome to Treasures from Malta, a podcast series produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. I am Francesca Balzan, an art historian and an artist with a long connection with Patrimonio. I'll be presenting this podcast and meeting some of Malta's living treasures. These treasures are artists, historians or art collectors with some Malta connection. They're all fair game for the pod and we want to share them with you. My guest today has had a very colourful career. Together with her husband, she has risen to become one of the leading exponents in rug design internationally. Her roots are Maltese, and indeed the first shop that set them both on their incredibly successful design path was a shop they opened in Slim on Malta. Since then they have never looked back, growing their business in several areas. From retailing traditional Oriental rugs, they made the leap into designing artistic high-end carpets, as well as commissioning big-name international artists and designers, and expanding into tapestry design and so much more. My guest has in recent years turned increasingly to interior design, furniture and wallpaper design, and even more. In truth, perhaps she did look back a little bit and she did return to her roots in turning a historic building into a unique hotel here in Malta, with the accumulated benefit of decades of travelling and hands-on experience in the design world. Suzanne Sharp, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Francesca. I'm so delighted to be with you today, and I'm really honoured that you asked me to be on this programme with you.
Suzanne, you've said that much of my style owes its origins to my nomadic childhood. Where did you grow up, and do you still consider yourself Maltese?
So I was born in Malta, and I spent the first 12 years of my life in Malta. It had a huge influence on me, as I was very lucky. I had a very happy, very free childhood. And I grew up in a very creative household. The women around me were super creative and they taught us everything. They taught us how to sew, how to cook, how to paint, how to draw, how to basically entertain ourselves. Because, you know, those were days when we didn't really have very much to entertain us. So yeah, I was really lucky to be born into a very creative family. And I didn't really realize what an impact it would have on the future of my life, you know? And I do consider myself Maltese because I think that I really understand the Maltese. Mm-hmm. You know, I grew up with those sounds, with those smells, with that language. The church bells, I mean, every, you know, those first years of your life create a very lasting impression, you know. And when I come back to Malta, when as soon as you get off that plane, you smell that smell that you only smell in Malta. You hear people talking and it's a sort of level, a tone that is only Maltese, you know. So you kind of feel it within, you know, you feel and hear things that probably people who aren't Maltese may not. So, yeah, I do consider myself Maltese, yeah.
So we've established that you were a naughty kid and you had your family really encouraged you to paint and draw. But what about your interest in design proper? When did it start? And were you trained or is it something that you grew into and basically taught yourself?
I think it started when I was a sort of teenager and I was sent to school in England. And it was quite hard to sort of settle into a whole new culture, a new climate, a new school. And the refuge was the art room. So there were like four or five of us, and at the weekends, because we were termly boarders, so we only went home in the holidays. At the weekends, we'd do our prep on Saturday morning, and then we'd just go into the art room. Mm-hmm. And it was quiet, it was peaceful, and we just all fed off each other, and we had ideas, and And it was very unstructured, so it gave us a lot of space to experiment. And I think that's where I realized that I really liked the kind of peace that comes with designing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very calming, and it's just quite nice to remove yourself from mm-hmm. any thoughts and just immerse yourself in something. So that's how it started.
Mm-hmm.
So we left Malta when I was 12, and we moved to Rome, and my father was setting up Air Malta in Rome. So suddenly we had access to travel, you know, because yeah. travel was something that we could suddenly do. He was in the airline business, and he met lots of other people from other airlines, and they'd be like, oh, you know, come to Bangkok, or come and stay with us in Singapore. And we, you know, we had all these friends who were also living in Rome, and none of us really were Roman.
Mm-hmm.
So we would bring friends to Malta, and then they would take us to their countries. So that's sort of how the traveling started.
And it never stopped, from what I understand.
And it never stopped. I remember the first proper traveling we did was we went to visit, my father had a sister who had gone to Australia in like 1947 or something, and he hadn't seen her all that time. And so when we went to Rome, he was like, okay, we're going to go and visit my sister. And it was a big emotional thing for him. And he was going to meet her children, who were sort of grown-ups who he'd never met. And on the way, we stopped in Bangkok. So we went to we went all over Thailand, and then we stopped in Singapore, and we tasted food that we didn't even know existed. And you've got to remember, this was the time before. I mean, now we're so stimulated visually by social media that you almost feel like you've been everywhere, but we hadn't ever seen or tasted any of these foods. So it was very, very, you know, you were almost like hyper excited by it, because it was such an experience.
How wonderful. So that must have impacted your later design sort of trajectory, I would assume.
Yeah, because, you know, you go to all these places and you see color and you see craft and you see people making things. And we did actually go to a lot of countries that were sort of, I guess, very different to the West, you know, with very, very different cultures. So, you know, different ways of weaving, of painting, of architecture, of religion.
Of course, yes. Did you go to design school at any stage, or literally your eyes and your ears to absorb all these?
No, I did. I went to this guy, he was called Leonard Pardon. He was in London. And he had a class, and he taught people how to do marbling and wood graining, and, you know, we used to do clouded ceilings and stenciling. And so I did that course, and I started off doing decorative wall finishes.
I see.
Painting furniture. And one of my first jobs was doing this really lovely shop in London. And then, you know, one commission leads to another. But that's sort of how I started.
Yeah. But and then, of course, the lucky break, so to speak, was the rug company. Now, tell me a bit about the incredible journey of the rug company. You took it from a single shop in Sliema. And, in fact, many will remember Christopher Shop, the carpet shop, Hussisana and Sliema. And then it just went on to become a multinational with several branches operating in the United Kingdom, the United States, and so many other countries. How did it all start, and how did it take off abroad?
Well, it all started, really. Chris and I lived in Saudi Arabia. And while we were there, there wasn't really that much to do entertainment-wise. And the only thing that we really could do was go out to the souks in the evening or to the big shopping centres. The big shopping centres were quite boring. You know, you just wander from shop to shop selling underwear and jewellery and makeup, whatever. But the souks were much more exciting because they were very old, and they sold carpets and silver and amazing ornaments and still quite a lot of traditional handmade products. And they kind of had an exotic vibe about them. So we used to really enjoy going there. And because Saudi Arabia is the home of Mecca and Medina, a lot of pilgrims come from all over the world once a year to do the Hajj. And a lot of them are quite poor. So they would bring rugs with them on the Hajj, and they would take them to these souks to sell, to barter, so that they could have money to go and do their Hajj. So there were like amazing rugs from Afghanistan, from Iraq, from Syria, from all these incredible countries. And we used to go, and we basically learned about rugs. We used to go and hang out in the rug souks.
And, at the source, really?
Yeah, at the source, and make friends with all the guys. And sometimes they'd phone us and they'd go, oh, we've got this amazing Bukhara. You've got to come and see it. It's really rare. And that's how it started. And then we became a little bit obsessed with it.
And what do you do when you accumulate so many carpets?
Well, that's it. So then we moved to Malta. We had masses of carpets, yeah. And we... that's right. So after Saudi, we decided that we were going to come and live in Malta. My parents were living there, and we got a taste of living in a lovely climate, and we thought it'd be quite nice. So we came to Malta, and we were like, what are we going to do in Malta? You know, we've got to find something to do. And we had all these amazing carpets in our house. And one day somebody came to our house and said, oh my God, you've got these incredible carpets. Can I send a friend over because he really wants to buy some for his flat? And we thought, well, do we really want to sell them? We're like, oh, well, why not? You know, we've got really great sources. We can buy more. Mm-hmm. And then it sort of started like that. And then somebody else, one of my uncles, said to me, you know, you should maybe open a shop. You should think about opening a shop. And that's how it kind of developed into the shop.
Really organically, with no particular plan.
No plan at all. It was just people being really interested in what we did, and then taking that interest to the next level, and then taking that next level to the next level. It was just a slow process, you know.
I suppose Malta was a good place for it, because even our old Maltese houses, although they don't really share anything common with Saudi and with the areas where these rugs came from, somehow they are the perfect backdrop for these rugs.
And also the Maltese really love rugs, you know. And so it was successful business in Malta. So Malta started in 1990.
Okay.
And we were there for 7 years. And then we moved to London in 97. Because we were at an age where we were like, okay, we can stay here, which is lovely, and we loved it, and we were super happy. Or if we want to grow our business and have a shot at it, we need to kind of get out of our comfort zone and, you know, go to London and really try and grow the business there. Because obviously,
it's quite a risky one. I mean, you were based in Malta, known in Malta, but to then take off to London, where
I know, and it was stressful but we always had that safety net of Malta in our heads. You're always like, you know what, if it all goes pear in London, we know that Malta's there and we can go back, but we've got to give it a shot.
So at that stage, you renamed it the rug company, because up till the time you were in Malta, it was Christopher Shop, no?
Yes,
was the shop.
Exactly. And then we went and renamed it the rug company, yeah, because we wanted it to be a little bit less about Christopher and more about all the different designers, and, you know, and we wanted to give it a sort of identity that wasn't about one person.
But also you changed your stock to a certain extent, because you stopped stocking just oriental traditional rugs and you went into the area of actually creating new designs.
Yes. So when we first started in London, we did have the same model that we had in Malta, but we soon realized that it was actually a really different market. And people were coming into the shops, and although they loved the rugs, they were looking for something that we didn't have. and that we couldn't buy. So, you know, it's not like we say, oh, yes, you know, let's go to India and get some control. They just didn't exist. So we came up with this idea. So Chris and I always used to have supper together every evening, and over dinner we'd talk about, you know, this guy came into the shop today and he wanted something, but it just doesn't exist. And, you know, it's so weird. More and more people are asking for these contemporary rugs. And so we came up with the idea of designing our own collection, which we did. But obviously your own collection is only your aesthetic, so it's very narrow. So then after that, we thought, well, okay, so let's take it a step further and let's invite 10 interior designers, well-known interior designers in England, to design a rug for us. So we did that, and that was really well received in the press, and it was really amazing, and those rugs are still really iconic today. So, you know, the first collection we did with people like Nikki Haslam, Nina Campbell, Mary Fox Linton, Kath Kidston, and I think it was just wonderful because obviously they brought a lot to our kind of design library, mm-hmm. because they are all very different designers, and it showcased that we could do so many different things, mm-hmm. and it showcased our quality, and they all loved the quality, and they're all people who would only work with very fine and good quality and good craftsmanship. So that's what sort of launched us, I suppose, and that's what set us on the road.
Suzanne, how did you convince them to take a sort of a chance on a relatively young, relatively unknown company?
I think what we did was we did our collection first. And we made lots of different samples, and we had a really beautiful shop with a nice little team. And I think that they came and they saw, and we talked to them and we explained what we were doing, and it was all really genuine, you know, they kind of trusted us. And it was also, if you don't like it, mm-hmm. it won't go out there.
You know, so you
are totally in control. It's your design. You will always own that design. It's always going to be yours.
And once you sign up a few big names, I assume the others fall in line then.
But it all happened so organically, and it was a sort of drip, you know. It started with Paul Smith, mm-hmm. and then Paul Smith was sitting next to somebody on an aeroplane, and he was talking to them about this collection he'd just done, and I was like, oh, my God, I'd love to do that too, you know. And it just slowly, and also once you're in a design community and you all get to know each other, then, you know, you do have access and you do see people and you meet them. And also at that time, there literally was nothing. I mean, now there's a lot more collaboration going on, a lot. But, you know, 25 years ago, we were pretty much the first collaborators.
So where was the first shop in London, and where did you move on to next?
So the first shop in London was on Lotts Road, just off the King's Road, which is next to Chelsea Harbour. Mm-hmm. So a lot of designers go to Chelsea Harbour to look for fabrics and to buy things. And then from there we moved to Holland Park. And the shop's been in Holland Park ever since. But we have since opened two more stores, one in Harrods and one in King's Road.
But simultaneously, you started opening up abroad, or you had agents or representation abroad as well. So across the pond in the US and other places.
So after London was going very well, and we had a lot of American clients who actually lived in London, and all of them would be saying, you guys have to open in New York. It's going to be, it will be so good for you. And so we took the plunge in 2003 and we opened a shop in Soho in New York. And it was real hands-on. You know, we were painting the shop, doing everything ourselves, really like, you know, DIY. But again, beautiful carpets. We had great press. And the first person we sold a rug to in New York City was Sarah Jessica Parker from Sex and the City.
Oh, my goodness me.
And we were like, oh, my God, this is an omen. Because it was really at the height of its sort of, it was at its peak. And we were like, oh, my God, this is an omen. You know, how much, you cannot get more New York than Sarah Jessica Parker. And then you see all the rugs in the movie. They're all in the apartment. So that was exciting. And, you know, these things, all these little things really matter.
Of course.
They're all little, like, oh, you know, like when Obama came to England to meet David Cameron, we got a call from Downing Street. And we're all sitting in the office, sitting in the studio, and suddenly the receptionist puts her hand over the phone and she's like, Susanna, there's someone on the line from Downing Street. And you're literally, your heart is pounding. You're like, oh, shit, what am I going to say? And then, you know, you get the press secretary saying, no, Barack Obama is coming to the UK and we want to present him with one of your tapestries. And can you do something bespoke for us? And we're like, yes, of course. And then he's like, great, he's arriving in 3 weeks. And you're like, oh, my God, they usually take like 6 months to make. Obviously, you can't say no, but suddenly there's an enormous amount of energy and excitement in the studio.
Of course.
And everyone works super hard, you know, working late, getting all sorts of people in to help. But we had lots of nice, exciting moments like that.
Of course. So you design in studio, but and then obviously they were executed abroad.
So most of our rugs were woven in Nepal by Tibetan weavers. And we had 3 productions there, 3 different productions. And yeah, so in London, in the studio, we draw up the designs, we collaborate, we go to the designers' studios. Sometimes we look through their archives and, you know, they put together what they think. And it's very collaborative. So there's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing. The initial process probably takes about 3 or 4 months. And then you have let's say 4 or 5 designs. You send them off for sampling. They come back. You get the little samples. You look at the colors. Then, you know, the designer will say, oh, I don't like this red. It needs to be a little bit lighter or darker. So the whole process of actually designing a rug with a collaborator probably takes about a year from beginning to end. The weaving part takes about 18 weeks.
Do you know a lot about process? How hands-on are you? Have you actually tried your hand at loom?
No, I can't weave at all. No, it's a really skilled, because it's not like knitting or crochet or something. It's very skilled and you have to be quite fast. And I think it's something that almost goes from family to family.
But is that a problem in the sense that have you ever created designs that are impossible to execute on the loom? Or is that not an issue?
No, because I understand the looms and how they work.
Now, in 2015, you sold the rug company, but you turned your sights then onto the design of interiors and accessories. Now, let's take a look at your very first interior design project. And this was the conversion of a Notting Hill villa in London.
Yes.
Of course. And it was so successful. It was covered extensively in the July 2020 edition of House and Garden. Tell me a bit about it. How did it all start and what was your design impulse for that?
Well, I worked together with a very, very, with an amazing architect, someone called Basil Walters, who I got on really, really well with. So that is already, you know, it's huge. And I really liked the clients. They were they're young, they were open, they were trusting. And it was, it's all about the people you work with at the end of the day, actually. It's all about the team. And the team is everyone, the clients, the builder, the architect, the decorator. And it just worked out so well in that particular project. So the design philosophy on that particular project was obviously we had to work around the family. And they have, you know, they have 3 children, 2 dogs, 2 cats. they're quite untidy. And so we wanted to create something that they could be really comfortable in, that had a lot of color, and that didn't rely on it looking immaculate. Mm-hmm. So it could be untidy and still look good.
A true home. Yeah.
And just using very lovely colors, and good, the architecture was really good. So we started off with the architecture. Mm-hmm. And once we got that in place and we had the kitchen structure and all of that, we started, and then we moved on to color, mm-hmm. and wallpaper. And then we did the big pieces of furniture. So we did it all in phases. We sourced some big pieces. So in every room, we made sure we had one really key piece.
Suzanne, London is one of the world's major design capitals. Now, how does one make it as an individual designer in a place that is so chock-a-block full of the top design talents in the world? This is where all of them converge.
I don't know is the answer to that. Literally, I feel like everything happens step at a time. There was no big plan, you know. I didn't think, oh, I'm going to go to London and I'm going to become like, I just did it literally one step at a time. You meet, you know, you do something that leads to something else. That it's patience, it's time, actually. And it's sort of work, you know, it's like a little bit like climbing a mountain. You just start step by step. There was no plan.
But I suppose you were in tune with the vibe of the time and you really managed to fill up that gap in the market. But also, whatever you were producing was of great quality as well, and people recognized quality.
I think the quality was really important. And I also think, as you say, there was a gap in the market and we filled it. And I think we filled it well. But also, I think we realized that in order to fill it well, the collaborations were really important. Mm-hmm. But that became apparent after we had done our own first collection. Mm-hmm. Because you think, actually, there are so many different design aesthetics in the world. Mm-hmm. And you do need to be able to tap into, like, you know, some people live in very modern apartments, other people live in very old houses. And you need to be able to work with all of that and treat it with equal reverence.
Absolutely. But speaking about collaborations, you've had a very wonderful recent collaboration with the Lacquer Company. Talk us through it.
So I met James, who owns the Lacquer Company. Actually, I met him about 10 years ago at a trade fair. He had a stand and we had a stand, and I was walking around kind of, you know, seeing what everyone else was up to. And I met him, and he was young. He was just starting out, and his product was amazing, really colorful, really beautiful, incredibly well made. And I talked to him and we had a good conversation and we got on really, really well. And that was it, you know. And then literally 10 years later, I got an email from him saying, Suzanne, I really want to collaborate with you. Do you have any ideas? Would you like to do it? So I said, well, come to my studio. Let's have a chat and let's see. And I had so many ideas, like ridiculous amount of ideas. And I said to him, but James, they're not all going to work. So we're going to have to sort of start. We'll have to, you know, he said to me, well, let's narrow it down. And then we started working on those. So I, you know, so the coffee table. So I was literally thinking, okay, when I'm doing my projects, when I'm doing the hotel, what do I really need that's really going to make, that's going to be that, you know, what special things do I need in each room that I can use? And the trays were my first thing, because I thought, you know, a beautiful tray with your drinks and your glasses, and it's always quite nice. And in the old days,
They've got these crenellations and they're really beautiful.
Crenellations, yeah, the castellations. So they came from, because, you know, we now do the Villa Bologna pottery in Malta.
Mm-hmm. We'll come to that, in fact, now.
Yeah, so all the little buildings around the pottery and also the outside walls of Villa Bologna are all castellated.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always really, really liked them. And that's kind of where the idea of the castellations came from.
And in fact, you keep tapping back into Maltese aesthetic, even in your designs for rugs.
Oh yeah, a lot.
Actually had designs which you've named after Calypso and other Maltese
elements.
So you always bring that back in a not obvious way. So it's not like you're trying to copy Maltese filigree or lace verbatim, but you're actually kind of making a twist on them.
Yeah, I'm just drawing on sort of feelings and ideas, you know, and things that I've seen. And also things that as a, you know, when I was a little girl, I used to love going to church.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved just looking around at all the different patterns and all. And they just stay imprinted in your head, don't they?
Yeah, I suppose.
Well, they did with me, looking at the floors. I mean, there's so much ornamentation in Malta.
For sure.
I mean, even all the carvings on the stone, there is so much. The doors all have all those beautiful mouldings on them.
So with the lacquer company, apart from the trays, you did small furniture items and...
Yes, I did two coffee tables, two size coffee tables, and then I did some low occasional tables. I did a luggage rack and mirrors.
So some years ago, you really truly returned to your roots by purchasing the historic Casa Bonavita Natod. Now, of course, that was a particularly important building, even during the French period, because it belongs to Judge Vincenzo Bonavita. He was a sympathizer of the French. In fact, he was blockaded in Valletta. And the Maltese didn't quite like that, so they actually ransacked his villa. So it's quite a layered history that there is in this house. It is based in it is sited in Attard, very close to the parish church, really at the heart of the Attard sort of historic center. And you took it over with a view to turning it into a small, very perfect and unique little hotel full of your design signature, I should say. Tell me about it and why take on such a big project so far away from what is now your home?
So, basically, when we bought the house quite a long time ago, and we bought it to live in ourselves, and we thought, oh my God, it's perfect, we'll just live in it ourselves. And so we did. We started living in it. And you know, when you start living in a house, suddenly it's winter and you're like freezing. More of the houses get so cold in winter.
And you think, that's why we love our rugs.
Yeah. And they're all, you know, and it's summer and it's boiling. And all of these things that you take so for granted when you live in London, like you never really feel hot or cold in London. You're always the perfect temperature because you have heating in the houses and it doesn't get too hot in the summer. And it was also quite a big house. So we did renovate it for ourselves. And that took us sort of, you know, that took us about 5 years. And then our daughter Sophie got married in 2017.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of our friends from all over the world came to the wedding, and it was in Malta. And everyone was like, oh my God, you're so brave taking all those people to Malta, you know, how's it going to be? Where are they all going to stay? And all of this. Anyway, they all came. People came from literally everywhere. And they loved Malta. Mm-hmm. Everybody loved it. And we showed them basically our Malta, you know, so they came to Attard, they came to our house, they had drinks in the garden, the wedding was at Villa Bologna, we had a day at the beach, you know, where we had a sort of beach party, and we did all of these wonderful things, and they were there for 4 days, and they obviously went to Valletta and Indina and did all the sightseeing. And afterwards, they all said, oh my God, next time I come to Malta, I want to stay in a house like yours, yeah? They were all staying in sort of kind of new hotels, I guess. And I suddenly thought, it would be really nice to do a hotel that was a house, really good service, really great food, really beautiful rooms, but that had the feeling of being in somebody's home. And a really old Maltese home with a lovely garden, the smell of the orange blossom, the church bells ringing. So you really feel where you are.
At that stage, you looked at your own house and said, we can turn this into a hotel.
Yeah. And then, but then obviously it wasn't big enough because you need a certain amount of rooms for a hotel. So we were really lucky in that the guy at the end of our garden wanted to sell his house, so we bought that. And then the next door neighbor wanted to sell his, so we also bought that. So we've slowly been turning those into more rooms, but it's been a really slow process.
Naturally.
Because, you know, the planning permission takes quite a long time, but everyone's been super helpful, super supportive. And I think it's going to be great. I think it will be really, really, I mean, I want it to be really great.
When is it D-Day, so?
No, Francesca. It's really hard in Malta to put an actual time on things, isn't it? But hopefully 2023.
Excellent.
I mean, definitely 2023.
Great. And how can we follow its progress?
We've been quite secretive about it. Because I think we want to do the big woohoo unveiling, you know. We've been, I think we probably will start some sort of Instagram page. I've done a few teasers on my Instagram, a few one bathroom down, you know, 17 to go.
I saw that one. Yeah. I mean, your feed, your Instagram feed is wonderful to look at. I mean, very, very colorful. I think it gives a bit of a flavor of what sort of design philosophy you follow. Very, very colorful.
You know, I'm really trying to... It's so hard with the design for that hotel. But I want it to be very Maltese.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously by very Maltese, I don't mean like pure Maltese furniture and pure Maltese switches. I mean very Maltese in the way that if you go into people's houses in Malta, well, I know when I was a kid and I used to go to my granny's house, there was such a mixture of stuff in there.
Mm-hmm.
So there'd be like a piece of furniture her nonna had given her. Mm-hmm. And a cushion that, you know, her sister had made her for Christmas. You know, there was a real...
A lot of stories coming together.
I want to tell all those stories. I remember in my granny's house, there was this picture, this really big portrait of this sort of man fishing on the Nile in a canoe. And he was wearing like a loincloth and he had a big turban on his head.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember saying to my nana, who is that man? And she'd say to me, I don't know, my granny brought it when she came back from Egypt, you know. So they all had stories around the Mediterranean. They all had people who'd gone to work in Alexandria.
Yeah.
My granny's sister lived in Tripoli. Someone else was from Ashdod, he went to Tunis, you know. There's a lot going on.
Absolutely.
And so I used to hear all these stories and ask about these things, and they were always coming from somewhere.
So just along the road, literally a few steps down the road, is the oldest pottery still operating in Malta. And you've got involved in it. It is based at the Villa Bologna that we mentioned earlier. And your daughter and son-in-law have been running it in recent years. Tell me about it. Tell me why you decided to go into ceramics at this stage and what you're going to be doing with this pottery.
Okay, so I've always loved the pottery at Villa Bologna. When I was a little girl, I had one of their piggy banks. You know, I just remember my mother buying things from there.
Yeah, really iconic pieces.
And going into the shop. I mean, it's been a big part of my life. And, you know, when I go to Malta, I always take friends there. It just really appeals to me, you know, the whole setting, the design, everything about it is lovely. And about 2 or 3 years ago, Jasper said to me, you know, the pottery is losing so much money, I'm going to have to close it down. I can't keep it going.
This is the owner and present operator of Villa Bologna itself.
Yes.
And I must mention that the pottery used to operate under the name Ceramica Saracina.
Anyway, so basically it wasn't doing well. They were about to close it down. And I thought, my God, that is tragic. That would be so sad. And so we offered to take it over. And the offer was accepted. And then Chris and I and Sophie and Rowley, you know, talked about it. And we said, you know, it can be something really important, but it needs a lot of work and it needs building up, and you need to invest in new equipment and training staff, et cetera, et cetera. And before you make any money, it's going to be, quite a few years. And anyway, so they've started and they're doing super well and they're opening a shop in London in April. Wow.
So a bit of Malta lands in London yet again. Follow
so
your footsteps.
That is what, yeah. So that's, yes. That's what I've been working on recently, doing up their new shop in London for them. It's a tiny little shop, but in a really great location. Mm-hmm. And I think in an area where people will really appreciate the craftsmanship, because it's all handmade, hand-painted.
But it's also very timely because, again, it seems that in these last 2 years when we're like struggling through the COVID period, everybody's turned to craft and to the appreciation of well-made, handmade objects. And ceramics in particular have really done well as a result. There's a sort of newfound appreciation of ceramics and, you know, things that are just unique pieces for the home, for people.
Yeah, no, I think so. I think it's goodbye to the white plates.
Exactly. The timing's right.
But also the product is so good. The lamps are so amazing.
Mm-hmm.
The designs are lovely. The fish plates are incredible. You know, it's really, I'm proud of it.
Great. Let's take a break and then we'll come back to delve deeper into your life in design. This episode, originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series and now being broadcast on Campus FM, is a conversation between me, Francesca Balzan, and my guest, designer Suzanne Shaw. And we're back. Don't forget to go to our podcast page on www.patrimonio.org to see pictures and links to what we've discussed in each podcast episode. Suzanne, we've talked a lot about design, but now really run me through your design process. How does a design start for you? I mean, you start from a color, a shape, the brief of a client, a crazy idea, and do you paint, do you draw, do you manually jot down your ideas, or do you turn to the computer? Is that your tool?
Definitely don't turn to the computer. I'm very manual.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I have these things that I call my vibe trays, and I've got this big stack of trays in my studio, and I often have an empty one on my desk, you know, and slowly I fill it up. I mean, with a piece of wool or a piece of lots of different things that take my, you know, that I just pick up along the way or I find in my studio. I've got a lot of stuff in my studio. I'm a real hoarder.
Great. Do you organize things by color or by shape, material, or in some way?
I have like obsessive days when I do. And then I will have weeks when I don't and it's just a big mess, but then I'll go back in and sort it all out and almost start from scratch. Start pulling things out again from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
But I am quite organized. Yeah. I've got, you know, all my blue colors together and all my reds, but when I'm working, it can all explode and then I have to sort it all out again. I wish I had a formula. My life would be so much easier, but I don't. Sometimes I sit there and I think I'm never, ever going to be able to design anything again. Because I literally think I've done it. I've run out of ideas. And then you come back 2 weeks later and you're full of energy, full of ideas. Sometimes you just need a break, actually.
So that leads me to asking you, it's the greatest cliche ever, but I'm going to ask you, what inspires you? What triggers a successful design? You say you go away with no ideas and then you come back, you know, totally inspired or with just the right idea. What does it for you?
So many different things, Francesca. I could literally be just looking through some books and something will spark, you know, something will ignite, a color, a pattern. And it's just, once you have that little spark, then you can keep going, you know. It could be, I take lots and lots of photographs when I travel, lots. It could be going through photographs. It can be going through things I've cut out. It could be going through collages.
Suzanne, what happens on a day, for example, when you set aside an entire day to design? You have a particular project in mind you need to kick off. What would you do on a day like that? Is that when you pull out all your samples and things and start filling your tray?
So basically, I have two rooms, yeah? One room, which is like my computer, my files. It's really calm. It's kind of like and all my books. And it's really, I try and keep it quite tidy. And so I go in there for calmness. And then once I start, I mean, it all happens sort of in my head. It doesn't happen on a piece of paper. And I start thinking, oh, yeah, that would be nice. And maybe that. And then I actually go into the studio room where all the samples are and everything. And I take out my, I've got these vibe trays. I call them my vibe trays. And I've got, and I take one out and I start, you know, a bit of marble. Let's put that red in and let's put this rug sample in and then let's put this fabric. And I just start building. And then I walk away, I go and have lunch or I have a cup of tea or whatever, come back, look at it, that's wrong, let's swap this around. And it's literally, you just do that, sometimes for days.
Sounds like a great formula.
I also have people who work with me. So, you know, they'll go in and add something or take something out.
If you had to describe your design hallmark, I mean, how would I be able to identify that a room or a piece of furniture or perhaps even a building has been designed, the interior design is by Suzanne Shaw? What is going to tell me that that is your hallmark?
People often say, you know, when I used to do the rug company, I used to do all the ads and all the catalogues. And people always used to say to me, oh, I always know when it's you because it feels like somebody has just been in the room. I guess I try and make places look like they're easy to live in.
Yes.
But not look like, feel like. I want them to be easy to live in. I want them to be comfortable. That's really important.
Yeah.
And colour. I like colour.
Suzanne, which is the design project that you're most proud of?
I think the building of the rug company brand, because it was very enjoyable and very exciting and very fast paced. And we sort of built a brand without knowing we were building one, if that makes sense. And I look back and I think, wow, you know, I'm proud of the team we built. We had an amazing team. It's like being proud of like your football team, you know, everyone's in it together. And I think that's what I'm most proud of, knowing that I can build that really good team.
Takes great skill to do that. You've been covered in Vogue, the New York Times, House and Garden, countless other really prestigious publications that specialize in international design. Now, how does it feel to have arrived? And is there pressure still to keep innovating, to keep in the news?
I'm not particularly sort of obsessed by keeping in the news, but with the key, I do carry on doing what I do because I love it. And I love being part of that design community. And for me, that was the reward of all of those kind of, all those amazing articles, and interviews that we've done. It was very nice to be accepted into this incredible community.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'll always be part of it. And I think, in the 90s, I mean, obviously design has been around forever, but it really, the 90s was a real explosion.
You were there at the right time as well.
Yeah, I think the timing was amazing.
We've briefly mentioned collaborations with artists and in your case, both with the rug company, but and then with your other project, which is called The Banners of Persuasion. And these were limited edition set of tapestries that you started on in 2008. You've collaborated with contemporary artists and designers of international repute. I mean, we've mentioned some, and I've seen lists of others that include Vivienne Westwood, Diane von Furstenberg, Paul Smith, Alexander McQueen, but also artists like Gary Hume, Gavin Turk, and a personal favorite of mine, Kara Walker, whose work I absolutely adore. Such a wonderful blend of the historic and the traditional with the very contemporary stories and important political statements. Now, how do you go about collaborating, and who is the creator here? Is it the artist or the artist together with you?
The artist is always in control. I mean, that was mm-hmm. always our thing, is that we don't interfere in the artist's work.
I see.
Never. And obviously we give the artist the technical support by providing the weavers, the good quality wool, the kind of vehicle for the publicity, all of that. But we don't get involved in any of the creative mm-hmm. process of the artists, because they are all such individuals. They're also always quite private people. And they all work in really different ways. You generally get to them through the galleries, and they, all of those tapestries were very much their work, nothing to do with us at all. We didn't dictate,
I see.
Yeah.
I see. So in a way you manufactured essentially for
Yes,
them.
And we created this exhibition called Banners of Persuasion, which was actually Chris's project. And it was a 3-year project. Okay. It was a really big project. He was really committed to it. Maybe one day we can bring it to Malta. It's an amazing exhibition. I mean, it would be amazing. It is so beautiful.
We have such a tradition. We have some wonderful tapestries, as you know.
That's sort of what triggered originally the idea, was those tapestries.
Please work on it. It would be wonderful. Really super, super idea.
Yeah, no, it's a beauty. I mean, we took it to Miami. We took it to New York. We exhibited it in London.
Oh, how lovely. Okay, that has to be done.
Yeah.
Where are the places that inspire you? We spoke about travel. And are you sort of drawn to hot climates or cold?
I'm so drawn to hot climates, Francesca.
I know you were lost in Kenya. We corresponded when you were there. Why Kenya in particular?
So we have a holiday house in Kenya on the coast. And so we spend quite a lot of time there. And it's like it's a sort of winter sun. So we usually spend Christmas, New Year, and a bit of January there. I'm very attracted to countries where there is life in the streets. Mm-hmm. I love interacting with people. I love seeing people. I love watching people. I love hearing people talk.
Mm-hmm.
And I like talking to strangers. So I love countries like Morocco. Oh. I love Egypt. I love Turkey. I love Italy. I love France. I love countries where, the climate is quite good in the summer, I suppose. Oh.
But talking about travel, and thank God we're back to traveling again.
Yeah.
give us an insider tip to London. I mean, what I mean is, if we need a great design experience, where would you recommend?
So I go, when I'm doing projects, I tend to go to various places. So I go to auctions.
Hmm.
And I love going to Christie's, and I love also going to a place called Pimlico Road,
mm-hmm.
which is where all the sort of high-end furniture, fabrics, wallpapers are. Amazing shops, beautiful shops. It's a beautiful road, actually. So I go to Pimlico Road, and then I love going to Kempton, which is a huge antiques market. And it's every 2 weeks. You have to get there at like 4:30 in the morning, and you arrive and it's dark and everyone has torches, and you rummage around and you find amazing stuff. And then, you know, suddenly it's dawn and the guys are packing up and going home. And then people come, and the vans come from all over Europe.
Mm.
You've got Italian dealers, French dealers, Belgium dealers, Dutch. So that's quite a good place to go, Kempton. Portobello on Saturdays is amazing. Portobello Market, there are lots of little antique centres. They're like these little, they have little stalls inside where you can buy bits of silver and stuff. That's a really nice day out if you're just sort of browsing. And then September's always a really good time to be in London, because it's when London Design Festival's on. So there's loads of events all over the city.
So that's our London trip sorted, thanks to you. Suzanne, I'm going to let you go, but not before I tell you thank you for your time. And it's been an absolute pleasure meeting you online this time, but hopefully we'll see more of you when the hotel opens up very, very soon.
Thank you so much, Francesca. And I was really honoured to be asked to do this. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Treasures from Malta on Campus FM. This was originally recorded as a podcast, and there are pictures and links to all we've discussed on the Fondazione Patrimonio Malti website under the podcast section. That's www.patrimonio.org.